Welcome to the Scuffed Podcast. I'm Adam Bells in Minneapolis. With me is Greg Velasquez in Des Moines. We talk about U.S. men's soccer. We gave quick reactions to the U.S. victory over Paraguay last week, right after the final whistle, but I thought we should start this episode by revisiting the game with the benefit of distance and time. One debate that's skittered across the internet is whether interim coach Dave Sarokin is doing a good job, and more specifically, whether his reported and hopefully delusional ambition to ascend to the job of permanent head coach is clouding his judgment when it comes to managing a squad that needs a long-term thinker at the helm. Greg, first of all, how you doing?
Doing great, Bells.
Good. Good to hear your voice. Let's start with our quibbles on Sarokin's performance. We sort of talked about how we thought everybody played last week. How did Sarokin perform, and is he doing a good job?
I think he's doing fine. The big piece that he had to do for this game, I think, was basically his call-ups, his selections. And I don't know too many people who had any issue with his selections. The two kind of main criticisms are tactics and maybe even a little bit of quibbling with his lineup choices, and then his substitution policy. So I think the biggest complaint, or the leading complaint I saw, was Doyle sort of leading the charge with his pass maps, specifically the lack of any activity in zone 14. I think that's sort of the big issue that he had with Sarokin's lineup and style play.
Right.
He saw what was coming, and that he was saying, we're playing 2-8s, no 10s. We're playing wingers who aren't particularly explosive. So why do we, there's no reason to think that this team is going to be able to do much in the center of the field up near the goal. And he was exactly right. There was sort of a dead end there. The complaint is that Sarokin was being pragmatic rather than doing his job, which was to get a lot of looks at players.
Yeah, that's sort of the like meta complaint, right?
Yes, and I think I kind of don't necessarily agree with that. I think if you look at his roster, there's no obvious player that you'd insert into that lineup who would be the 10. So your roster is sort of 10-less. So you don't have a solution for that in this camp. So you play your 2-8s. It might be pragmatic, but it's also the best way to evaluate the guys that are in the camp. It's not going to be a good evaluation of Marky Delgado if you stick him in as a 10. He's going to look terrible because he's not a 10.
Right. Yeah. No, I totally agree. I put that in my newsletter this week too, that we just don't have any attacking quality. I think I said it last week, so maybe I'm a clanging cymbal at this point. But we don't. We don't have any really good strikers. We don't have any attacking midfielders or wingers other than Christian Pulisic, who has proven to be dangerous. So yeah, I'm with you. I don't blame Sarokin you could nitpick and say maybe he puts Kenny Seff. I got that right on the last pod. Kenny Seff at the 10. Maybe that works. I don't know. But
right, that's getting pretty experimental though, and so I think the first order of business with Kenny Seff was to see if he's comfortable in his most comfortable position,
right,
which would be out on the left side. So you get that data point in this game. You've got other games to get other data points. So I think it was just more a case of, it's not always as simple as just like sticking to get activity in that zone 14. It's not like the solution is like, oh well, you just play an Andrew Carlton, or you just stick. I don't know if some of these people wanted like a Sasha Kljestan or Benny Fellhaber called up. I don't think anyone was clamoring for that.
No.
It's not that easy. And to sort of succeed there, and the U.S. hasn't had much success playing through Zone 14 for the last decade. So there's no reason to think that this is sort of a failure of Sarokin, that they didn't have that success. I kind of believe that our lack of quality in that region stems from issues farther back along the field. So I don't think I think that we did a decent job of addressing some of those issues.
Yeah. Well, so if the tactics weren't deliberately safe in a way that prioritized the near term over the long term, which I think is part of the meta complaint against Sarokin, what about the substitutions? Why didn't he, that's another one of the big criticisms. He only brought Timmy Weah in the 86th minute, didn't bring Anthony Robinson or Eric Palmer Brown onto the field. He left 2 of 6 possible substitutions on the table. One of his subs was Christian Roldan, who, I mean, I don't really need to see too much more of him. Maybe that's harsh. What about his substitution?
I think that kind of plays into my defense again of Sarakin, in that we don't need to see Roldan again right now. A couple of those attacking subs were reaches even to have included. We're just so thin that we bring in a Novakovic or a Kakuta Mane. Like, those guys not getting too much time might be an indication that they probably just aren't in the picture. You know, we bring in a second division Dutch player because he's scoring goals, and so it's like, okay, well, let's take a look at the guy. I'll ask you, I guess, who on the bench did you really want to see get in that game? Where you're like, Sarakin missed this chance with these guys. I have a feeling I know which two especially, but go.
Well, the only one that I really wanted to see and was disappointed I didn't see was Anthony Robinson. I didn't have any need to see Eric Palmer Brown after, like, you know, an appearance and a half in Belgium, and I've sort of been vocal about my hesitance to crown Timmy Weah as the next, you know, the next great American winger. Rubio Rubin, he got a good run out. Didn't do a ton. How many minutes did you say? Was it like 20, 25?
25, 26 if you count the injury time.
Yeah. I mean, that's fair. I guess tactically, I thought we did get tired in that game around the 60th minute, and we could have used some fresh a greater infusion of fresh legs, but there's nobody that I was like terribly disappointed not to see. And Anthony Robinson, go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead. Finish
well,
on Robinson.
Well, Anthony Robinson is not playing right now for Bolton, which I don't claim to understand that. It's really hard to watch those championship games, but he hasn't started 5 games in a row. One of those was because of national team duty. It's not like he's the automatic starter he was a month ago or 2 months ago at the moment. Long story short, I'm not mad that we didn't get to see more of any of those guys. And, well, I'll let you go ahead. Go ahead.
I'll go a little bit even further and actually sort of defend Sarakin's match management. The goal, and I think a lot of people begin their criticism of it, was saying the goal with Paraguay is to see new faces. And I'd say the goal was to assess these players, some of these new faces, and actually give them a test. And I thought Sarakin did that. I thought, you know, he gave Trapp, Tyler Adams, Matt Miazga, Zach Steffen, CCV Delgado, those guys all got 90 minutes. Like, I think that's a good way to assess them. I don't necessarily think it's you don't have to see everybody immediately. Mm-hmm. I kind of like prolonged assessment in one game, and then in the next game, I almost say it's evidence that this could be evidence that Sarakin has a natural plan in place for sort of the process. Maybe I'll get burned for that in May when he explodes thing. But like right now, I'd say that this is a better way of going about this assessment. You know, what happens if we had put 4 brand new faces on the back line and then the whole thing's a mess? Like, what did we learn about any of them at that point? It might have just been one guy struggling, or it might have been all 4 of them. Here, we got to see, we got a real good look at Miazga and CCV with some known quantities in the fullback roles. So I think we learned quite a bit about Miazga and CCV. I don't know how you feel about it, but I mean, do you feel confident now that those are safe options for the next camp?
Yep, totally do. I totally feel like they can get the job done. They showed they can get the job done together. I'd be happy with either of them, with, you know, some combination of Cameron or Brooks, that is Jeff Cameron or John Brooks. And that is useful. I agree. It's totally useful. And it seems to me, what's the alternative? You treat it like a scrimmage where you just, you know, like you said, do a complete line change on the back line where the result doesn't matter at all. Is that what people are asking for? We don't care. We don't care if we win at all. I don't think anybody is thinking that. And I would argue, you know, with the help of some stuff I've read from Brian Strauss at Sports Illustrated, I think he sort of nodded at this point a couple times. We need, part of Sarakin's job is to reestablish some kind of winning culture, some kind of meritocracy. And I guess there's sort of 2 components to that. One, you reward the players who perform the best in training, with playing time, and you don't reward the players who didn't perform the best in training. Now, who knows if Sarakin is a fair arbiter of that? We're just going to have to trust him because we're never going to know. And the other component is just winning. You know, I think the more I think about it, it's good that we won that game. I'd much rather win it than lose it. You want those young guys, Tyler Adams, Marky Delgado, to become accustomed to winning when they're wearing the national team shirt. I think that's important, and more important than it was to give, you know, a championship level 20-year-old left back, you know, 30 minutes, and definitely more important than playing anybody else on the bench. So I'm sort of coming around. I'm not a huge fan of Sarakin. I hope he doesn't get the job. I assume he won't. But it seems okay what he did against Paraguay.
I think there's another component even to the winning piece, and I think it's fantastic. Like, I think you're 100% right that you need to essentially develop a culture where the players are competing for a win every time. Mm-hmm. And I think making six changes in the last 40 minutes of a game kind of takes the air out of that. But also you need to, I mean, the players clearly wanted to win that game, and Paraguay wanted to either come back and score or to, you know, hurt somebody. They wanted to, you know, essentially get in our heads. So I think it's an important data point too, to see how did Matt Biazga handle that? Like, if you sub him out with 20 minutes to go just to get a look at CCV, then you're missing 20 minutes of Miazga defending in a game where we're really trying to hold on to a 1-0 lead. And I just think that's an important piece of information to have. Mm-hmm. So get that in this game, and then in the next game, if you still want to see what Eric Palmer Brown looks like, now you move him in and you let him play a 90-minute game as a center back, because I want to see how he would play if he were the center back, not like a 70-minute cameo. I hate those like nonsense cameos in friendlies. I don't think you learn anything from putting a fullback out, you know, in for the last 15 minutes of a game.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just getting more and more certain in my position on this. So maybe that's a good segue to move on to talking about the rest of what we learned from the game. If we think Sarakin's doing all right, good job, Dave. Let's let's come back in a second.
Yeah, you can't screw this up. Play the kids in a way that, you know, you'd expect them to play with a full selection available, and then evaluate them on their own merits.
Okay, so another thing that's been going around, and we've said it too, I think we both use the word meaningless when we talk about these games. And in the sense that we're not going to the World Cup, sure, everything the national team does is robbed of immediate meaning. But I've decided in the last week or two, with the help of some people on Twitter.com, that this is not meaningless anymore. We have a maximum of 13 friendlies to play before we launch into a busy summer 2019 with a Copa America and a Gold Cup, probably, hopefully, two different squads. And we're only going to get those 13 friendlies if the Fed schedules the maximum number with the available windows. So
yeah, I would have a second game in this window. That would have been a nice change to be able to have thrown in those guys who got who didn't get in or who only had cameos, to give them a 90-minute shift.
Would have been perfect. I did a little comparison on some other nations that aren't going to the World Cup, and Italy did have two primetime friendlies in the window, but a lot of other nations not going to the World Cup did not have two, only had one. So
that means that they were available to play against.
That's true. That's true. What the F? Carlos.
Call him up. It happened.
Yeah. So that would have been nice. But with that in mind, I think we can we agree that we should sort of dispense with the meaningless friendly trope at this point?
Yeah, I will dispense with that if again it looks like we have a plan. If we play another friendly like the January one, I might get back onto that. But if we seem to actually have a plan, and we're sort of taking logical progressive steps towards building a player pool or a hierarchy, then I'll be like, okay, this is really useful use of our use, you know, a useful way to use these friendlies.
Okay, so probationary meaning.
Yes,
assigned very by much. Velasquez. Excellent. With that in mind, let's talk a little bit more about what we learned from the Paraguay game, because we have a little more time. We've had a little more time to think about it. Let's get into it. Do you want me to start or do you want to start?
You go right ahead, Bells.
Okay. We talked about this last week, but it bears repeating. I was really persuaded that Tyler Adams is an international caliber center midfielder. We don't have to go on at length because I know we talked about it a lot already. But as a number eight, as you pointed out, he is a huge asset with a lot of forward thrust and a lot of defensive coverage. His ability to press and break up the other team's rhythm is clearly valuable, and I want to see him. I want to see him and McKennie next to each other as the eights. While I don't think he's ready to be a number six with his skill set yet, particularly his passing and his, you know, turning and passing, I just don't know if I'd trust him in that role. I don't bet against him developing into that role, because he's developed so much, and even in the last, I feel like, 2 months, he's gotten so much better in the middle of the pitch. So I think that's the, you know, with some other things, as close second to me, that's the number one thing we learned, aside from just the general, hey, the 4-3-3 is starting to look pretty solid, and hope you weren't going to say that and I stole your thunder, but why don't you give something?
No, I'm the only thing I disagree with is I feel like that's convincing me that he shouldn't be the six. I think he what he offers as an eight makes the life of the six a lot easier, and probably makes the life of whoever's going to play next to him a lot easier, whether it's McKennie or it's going to definitely be McKennie. Like, I think that's the range he has is such an asset to a number of styles that we could end up employing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he seems very – McKennie you're talking about, right? Or are you talking about Adams?
Adams is range, but what, like, he'll offer for, like, playing beside a McKennie with a Bradley or a Trapp behind them.
My only long-term issue with that is I'd like to have a midfield where we have a, you know, Keaton Parks, Wes McKennie, Tyler Adams all on the field at the same time.
And that would be glorious.
Yeah,
Bells May. That'll be the next step, buddy.
But I hope so. I mean, Keaton didn't get in the 18 for Benfica's last match, and that's more the rule than the exception. Best case scenario, he develops into a starter at Benfica at the 8 or the 10 or even the 6. If he becomes a 6, then all the better, you know. But he's got some attacking third quality that I think we'd like to use eventually. So anyway, Adams establishing himself not only as a, in my view, guaranteed call-up for every national team roster from here on out, but as a good center midfielder. That was the biggest takeaway for me from the match.
Yeah, and that was, again, a really important thing to learn.
Yes.
So right there, you can say, definitely not meaningless, right? That's a great data point. That's going to be great for whatever roster Sarakin puts together in May and whatever starting 11 he puts together in May.
Yep. We'll see. Hopefully good for his confidence too, because he's got to play down in Guadalajara tonight. Adams, that is, against Chivas.
Sure. Depending on when you're listening to this.
Oh yeah, we will probably not publish this by that time. Sorry, everybody. All right. Give me a takeaway.
All right, so for me, it actually is that, like, my big takeaway is sort of what the main criticism was, in that we are going to have to, in the short term, create a style that de-emphasizes, like, a number 10. A lot of guys look really good, but we still have that. So we basically, you know, there are other ways to manufacture chances other than the string-pulling playmaker. And until such time as that materializes, there's no guarantee that we're going to have one. It's not like we have a guy in the pool who just wasn't available. We don't have a proven number 10, but we do have a lot of other quality players that can do other things. So we might be trying to adopt a style that doesn't rely on that position. Yeah, does that sound like I'm conceding or surrendering that we just won't be able to play the fluid final third style?
Yeah, no, I think that's realistic and unavoidable, pretty much. And I do think, as I've said before, I do think if McKennie's in there, he creates quite a bit more fluidity. If Pulisic is there, obviously he destabilizes the back line by beating people.
I agree with you there, but I feel like a lot of people have Pulisic penciled in their head as he could be the 10. And I feel like we've gone back and forth on this. There's just no way in my mind that Christian Pulisic is like a playmaker or somebody who's going to have that one slide rule pass that unlocks a defense and springs somebody.
Yeah, it's one of the great myths. It's one of the great contemporary myths in American soccer that Christian Pulisic is a playmaker. He's just not.
He can step in there because we don't have one, and he can run at people, and it will be scary for them. And it may be effective at times, but he is definitely not a 10. Like, we're not going to get we're not going to turn into Manchester City pinging passes together in the final third to score goals.
No. I mean, I don't mind if Pulisic has a little freedom on the wing. You know, if he floats a bit and, you know, drops centrally and grabs the ball every now and then, that's great. But to imagine that he's going to be sort of the epicenter of a creative force spraying passes all over. No, he does not have the vision for that. Yeah, I mean, just to piggyback on your point, I think the 4-3-3, this style that we're developing, I was really encouraged that it appeared to be quite stable. You know, it was hard for Paraguay to get anything done. And if we're building that foundation, that's more important than scoring goals. You got to be able to stop other people from scoring goals. And I thought we saw the beginnings of that.
So not only were we very stable in defense, but we were much more coherent even with the ball, which isn't the worst way to play defense either. So if we can just kind of keep the ball with that level of composure, it was very tidy. Like, it wasn't a lot of like putting the ball between us and them and just out muscling them for it. Like, we were just controlling things very comfortably. That is a big progression for us as a national team, and I would be very happy. Like, I think that is a sustainable way to keep ourselves in games against sort of more traditionally successful national teams.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, we don't need to go through every position, but I'd say with the benefit of the Champions League match last night, which reinforced a lot of what we saw against Paraguay.
Your Toronto TFC versus Club America.
Yeah. So I'm talking about Marco Delgado. He was impressive. I think we were both impressed with him against Paraguay. He was really impressive last night. He's an interesting player because I was having a debate with somebody about him. Like, oh, he's just another. Somebody said, oh, he's just another Nagby. Possession without purpose kind of player. And we don't need more guys who aren't really game changers on the national team. He's a stopgap measure. And I don't agree with that. I mean, I'm not ready to say Delgado is a nailed on starter or anything, but I am ready to say he's probably first off the bench in the midfield. In my mind, he's ahead of Acosta now and definitely ahead of Roldan. Probably ahead of Danny Williams, although he doesn't play the six.
He had been off my radar forever. I didn't know that much about him even going into the January camp. Didn't know much about him going into Paraguay. He was just so clean. Again, he just seemed to do everything that I wanted to say at the time, everything the manager asked him to do. But really, I think that's just what Delgado does after seeing him again in the Champions League. Like, he just has such a simple game where he plays in his limits and sort of lets the game dictate, and then he just executes it really well. That's a guy that I think I appreciate, a Darlington Nagby type, and I think Delgado's a little different in that he's more of a rhythm possession player. Nagby's kind of at times Nagby will just be in the rhythm of a possession, but at other times Nagby will, like, try to create something. You know, Nagby will hold it and try to spin someone or hold it, and basically Nagby will try to bait somebody into something and then use their whether they overcommit to create a new space. And Delgado seems like very much a linking player. He's just going to link constantly.
Yeah. Yeah, rhythm is a key word. I think I kept thinking that when I was watching him play last night. He's every time he touches the ball, he puts it at the feet of a teammate in a place where they are ready to play, you know, ready to play forward, or the game just starts moving faster anytime it gets near him. And it's not because he's taken anybody on. I don't think he took anybody on one time last night. Those little linking passes, if they're handled cleanly and then followed up with intelligent off-the-ball movement, which I think is another hallmark of his game, having watched him these two times, that can create a lot of problems for an opposing team. I mean, he'll recover the ball, quick little pass back to Bradley, and then he's off to the races, and he's like clearing out space, or he's finding himself on the ball a couple passes later. I'd really be interested to see how that works, you know, with McKennie or with Adams, or, you know, with some combination of other guys who are maybe a little more willing to try to beat somebody or play a brave ball, because he doesn't do a ton of that.
Right. Right. He's excellent in making sure the ball eventually gets to a Giovinco or an Altidore.
Right.
Like, he's vital to it getting there. If you weren't involved in the little chain of passes, it wouldn't have gotten to your key guys, and so you lose out on scoring chances.
Right. And he's capable of, you know, he showed last night he's capable of some cheekiness. I mean, he had a little back heel to Giovinco in the box that was just right in stride.
I was watching that game and then watching your thread this morning, and I was almost like, Delgado at this point is sort of the player that you're really wanting Andrew Carlton to turn into.
Oh man, if Andrew Carlton played with his sort of commitment and intelligence all the time, he would be, I don't know, the best number 10 since Diego Maradona, probably. kidding, everybody. I'm kidding. Yeah, so Delgado, just to wrap up my side of the Delgado thing, I he's been a revelation to me, and I really like him. And I think, you know, maybe he's not like a future national team starter, but boy, he's an asset. And
so I feel like what you get in a Delgado, and I think what we're starting to see a little bit of a trend of in this group of like 18 to 23-year-olds that are really like getting into the picture, is they're better than the guys that were sort of staple. I think they're a little more effective than sort of the fringe-ish guys that were staples for the last 10 years. Like, I feel like a Delgado is a cleaner player than like an Ali Bedoya. And it's because of, like, the point you made earlier, he doesn't just connect the next pass. Like, he gets it to the exact, you know, point that sets up the next teammate's pass. And I don't know that we ever had that from a Bedoya or a Zuzi. They'd be decent at, you know, they'd be there to receive a pass and then hit the next one, but it wouldn't lead to anything.
Right.
And I feel like the next group is a little cleaner and maybe has a little bit more almost like understanding or vision of knowing, all right, well, then the next sequence is going to be this and then this. So I'm hoping that that's the trend and that Delgado's sort of another piece of that trend.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's almost like, because the Bedoya comparison does come to mind, because Bedoya was kind of a shuttler and a hard worker, and there's a temptation to call Delgado a shuttler and a hard worker and like leave it at that. But it's almost a disservice to call what he does shuttling. I mean, I don't know the technical definition of the word, but it's, you know, sometimes used in a derogatory way, like, oh, he can just shuttle the ball. But
right.
It's a disservice to Delgado to refer to it that way, because he puts the ball in places that make it easy for the next guy to make a play. You know, it's not just he manages to get it to their feet. It's like he's setting them up for success and putting them in a place where they have momentum. I mean, that happened so many times last night. And he had the assist before the assist on the third goal.
Because I immediately started thinking of that, where he adds a little bit of disguise while ball's traveling to him 30 yards in the air.
Yes.
And then you know, cuts it in and hides the fact that he's going to hit the overlapper. And that's exactly what I'm saying. Is like, if he's not even a guy who's going to be starting for us because you've got McKennie and Adams and Bradley, like that's such a leap to have that kind of caliber of a player as your fourth best center mid.
Right. Right. I mean, that play was really impressive. And I think a lot of people probably are just like, oh, he just brought down that ball and just, you know, made a simple pass to RO, his wing back. But no, like you said, he didn't check his, he checked his shoulder like four or five beats before his ball got to him. So he's like, he travels like 15 yards without ever looking at RO because he already knows he's there. And the ball's coming through the air. Like you said, he takes a touch towards the middle to kind of make it look like he's coming inside, all the while knowing he's going to play it to RO because he's seen him like 5 seconds earlier. And without ever looking at RO, plays that ball perfectly on a platter for him, just teases it out there in front of him. I don't know, man. There's so many ways to screw up that chance. And that deception, and there were other examples of like little subtle deceptions that he uses throughout the game. He's a quiet performer. You don't see a lot. The announcers hardly ever call his name, but when you start watching him closely, it's a little bit like Jonah Gonzalez. When you start watching him closely, you see that he's just really, really smart. I think it's smart. Smart is the word that kept coming to mind, second only to rhythm. Smart, yes. And rhythm. Yeah,
you need to have that intelligence if you're going to continue to keep the rhythm. You have to already know where you're going to go with it. So Delgado, I think, yeah, definitely making a strong case for himself through national team and through Toronto.
And I think you're right. It's like if he's the fourth or fifth best center mid on the in the pool, fantastic. And maybe that is a giant leap.
In my mind, yeah, that's the direction these kids have to take us.
Come on, kids.
I don't want to have like filler. I don't want to have placeholders. Like I want to have, like everyone able to come in and really actually make an impact and have some influence on the match.
Yeah, he is certainly. I mean, Delgado is certainly capable of that, and very encouraging. But let's leave the Paraguay match there, unless you got any other thoughts.
No, I'm good. I'm like, I'll have retroactive thoughts once the May rosters and lineup come out.
Yeah. Okay, we'll be right back and we'll talk a little bit about Major League Soccer. Obviously, the big news from Major League Soccer this week was Zlatan, the brace for the win over LAFC in the first ever El Tráfico. Thoughts, Greg? Did you watch
Welcome, Zlatan. Oh, man. So I watched that game. I feel like everybody watched that game. And I didn't even – just seeing him on the sideline was fantastic. Like, the guy has basically bought he's bought, like – all credit for his lifetime. As far as I'm concerned, like the moment he hit a 45-yard bicycle kick against England in a friendly to score on an open goal, I was just like, he can do whatever he wants. He will always be sort of like a worthwhile. You will watch him no matter what. I don't care if it's a play. I don't care if he comes out of retirement and plays in the World Cup. Like Zlatan is appointment viewing.
Yeah, it's true, man. He was dominant for Manchester United last season. I mean, he's 36 years old, but he could be, you know, if he can recover from this knee injury, look out.
Well, I think he kind of joked in his interview. He's just like, I made a run the first time I got it, and I was like out of gas. So the second time, I just decided to shoot. If it's to the point where he just doesn't run anymore and just will collect the ball and score bangers from 35. like, yes, please. Just even the attempt is worthwhile when it's Zlatan.
Oh, man. It was so great. It was so great. I thought the context of it was, I mean, just the whole thing was just a dream sequence. I had a little time to myself on Friday night, so I watched a good deal of the introductory press conference, and it was, I mean, maybe not appointment viewing, but it was good television on YouTube to watch him, you know, take questions from the press corps and talk about how the Lion is hungry and he's going to win trophies here. I mean, he just makes every brag in the book, and he does it in a great way. Like, it's all sort of like wink, wink, nod, nod, you know? Like,
yeah, he's having fun with the whole thing, man. It's great.
And then he just absolutely delivers. It's unbelievable. I mean, LAFC was in chaos, basically from the moment he came on the pitch. Incredible. Is there anything more to say about it that hasn't been said?
The only thing I'll say, in addition to it, is for whatever reason, like when his signing was announced, when he was getting votes after his 2-goal performance for Player of the Month. Like, I'll just say, you can tell immediately somebody who doesn't actually enjoy watching soccer when they start complaining about Zlatan's presence in the league. Like, anyone who says that, you can just immediately rule out and just be like, oh, they don't actually enjoy watching soccer.
Right.
They are in it for some kind of like an ego, pride, weird like bragging rights thing. They don't actually enjoy soccer.
Yeah, takes like that. I mean, there's like a whole culture of takes, soccer takes out there that is just like so boring. What lives these people must lead to complain about Zlatan and MLS. CONCACAF Champions League, we touched on it a little bit with my pay on to Delgado, but Toronto beat Club America 3-1 in Toronto in the first leg of a 2-leg series. What do you think? So do you think Toronto's going to pull it off?
I don't, you know, I actually do think they will. Like, I was watching it, and it wasn't like a fluke the way Red Bulls were in their first leg in Mexico, the last in the quarters.
Against Tijuana, yeah.
Yeah, so, and I know this is at home for Toronto, but they kind of looked like they weren't threatened that much, you know what I mean? Like, Bono had to make one save. A really big save there at the end to deny that a second away goal. But I felt like Toronto adapted really well to what Club America sort of threw at them. Club America sort of, their tactic was to put some extra pressure on Michael Bradley, I felt like, and deny him that his favorite thing to do, which is just to collect the ball from the back line and then spray it all over the field.
Right.
So I thought they were effective at taking that away, but obviously that means you're going to sacrifice other areas. And I thought, partly because of Delgado and a lot because you have Giovinco, that TFC adapted very well and exploited everything that Club America left open.
Yeah, well, I mean, Altidore had a great game. I thought Giovinco didn't have his best game ever, but he did draw that penalty. Yeah, Toronto looked like the better team by some distance, in my opinion, and then they were missing Mavinga, who's their best center back. They're missing Justin Morrow, the much maligned national team left back, but you know, a valuable piece for Toronto, and I think they were missing one other guy. Victor Vasquez, their sort of playmaking midfielder / winger. So they got depth. They seem well drilled, and a lot of pretty passing between Bradley, Delgado, Giovinco, and Altidore.
And that's all stuff. Since they were already putting a bunch of pressure sort of high up the field, I feel like it's all sort of replicable. So when they go to Mexico City and they're in this hostile environment, and you know, you're always worried then that, oh, all right, there'll be more pressure to deal with. They handled that pressure really well. It's not like Club America sat back on the road and then at home they're going to press TFC and force a bunch of mistakes. Like, they tried to do that in TFC, and Toronto didn't necessarily carve them up, but they found the open areas often enough to be dangerous, or at least to relieve that pressure. And I feel like they can do the same thing in Mexico City. Like, I don't think there's any wrinkle Club America can throw at them other than it being at altitude and having maybe a more hostile support group.
If I had money to bet on it, I would bet on Toronto at this point.
I'm booking tickets to the final. I'm booking tickets to the final with my Toronto scarf.
Are you a Toronto fan?
No, I purchased it specifically for this game. Marky Delgado is my new favorite player, and I'm going excellent. To be a full-throated Marky Delgado supporter.
Excellent. So it's kind of like me with Atlanta United.
Yes. He's my Andrew Carlton.
We'll probably meet in the Eastern Conference semifinals. It's my guess.
Let's talk about your kids. Let's talk about the rest of your kids besides Carlton, who was unfortunately ill for his visit to your hometown.
Yeah, he had strep throat, which I thought was like a, you know, an elementary school disease. But
yeah, they're kids, Bells. The kids get illnesses like strep throat and have ear infection.
I'm a little sour about it. I went and sat at TCF Bank Stadium in 19 degrees weather, which doesn't sound so bad, except there was the wind chill. The wind chill was the clincher. It was really cold, and it was a 1-0 game that Minnesota United couldn't crack a 10-man Atlanta for 60 minutes, I think. Very committed fans up here in Minneapolis, but that was not my best professional soccer viewing experience. Anyway, Carlton was not around, and so I got three kids to bring up real quick. I'll just bang through them real fast, and then you can rain on my parade if you want. Justin Glad had a rough time in Toronto last weekend, conceded a penalty by bundling Jozy Altidore over in the box. RSL doesn't look too good, and Glad has had a couple of rough performances. Came into the season tapped as a potential defender of the year, and hasn't started off the way, you know, some of us had hoped for him.
I think Justin Glad is in an unfortunate position at RSL right now, where, you know, he's going to have a hard time looking good, just by the way that the whole team is sort of floundering. The last line is always going to be the line that looks that, you know, he's always going to be on the highlight for the goal.
Right.
Because he's the last guy. But there's a lot of issues there that I think he's definitely not. He's not the reason that they're struggling defensively.
Yeah, I agree. It just doesn't look good. That's the only thing. And I mean, maybe smart soccer coaches can look past that. But yeah, RSL looks like against Toronto, which is obviously a good team, they look like they didn't have a plan. They didn't look like they could execute a plan if they had one. And I'm talking from, you know, all 11 guys. It looked really bad. Toronto could have scored a lot more goals than they did. But that I agree with you. It's not his fault necessarily.
No, it's one of those things where if he were pulling off miracles, that would be awesome. That would really count in his favor. If the rest of the team was, you know, poor in front of him and he was still, you know, standing on his head to deny chances and clean up messes for his teammates, that would be great. I don't think we're really seeing that either, which, again, isn't necessarily mean he's doing poorly, but it'd be great if he were somehow keeping Real Salt Lake afloat.
Yeah. So maybe that's the silver lining, is he's going to get a lot of practice at last ditch defending, which is, you know, something good to have up your sleeve. Now, a similar situation is Chris Durkin at DC United. Another pretty poor performance from Ben Olsen's side, and a very pretty ragged performance from Durkin himself at Sporting KC. They lost 1-0, conceded an early goal, but Durkin didn't do any of the sort of clever passing or clever long balls that. Clever's not the right word, or, you know, precise diagonal balls that we've seen from him in other performances. Good experience for the kid, but we'll see what happens with his minutes. I think he'll keep getting minutes and keep getting better, but not a shining performance.
All right, let's get to the positive then, Bells.
Bello, George Bello, one of the kids I rate very highly, got his debut in USL. At the age of 16 against the Charlotte Independents. He's barely 16. He's an attacking left back, and he was a menace for Atlanta United too. He's good on the ball, really good on the ball. Looks plenty strong enough to deal with the professional men he was up against. And he kind of forced an own goal, helped create some other chances, defended very well. He did not look match fit, and he got pretty gassed, looked like to me, in the second half. And in the something like the 86th minute, allowed a cross to be hit from his side that resulted in the equalizer, which is unfortunate. But he only deserved, what did you think it was, point like 3% of the blame for the goal, something like that?
Well, it's I was trying to come up with some kind of an expected goals allowed stat. So okay. I think the expected goal of any one cross is like 0.03. Maybe that's of a corner kick. Corner kick expected goal is like 0.03. So when you concede a corner, even if they score on it, you've really only conceded 0.03 expected goals. So I was trying to bail young Bello out a little bit of any blame for the actual goal. And I still kind of do. I mean, the guy's got the ball on the wing and he gets a cross off. That's not some fatal mistake from a defender. You've got a lot of jobs. You've got to prevent him from getting around you, which is the most important one. So you have to allow some things, and a guy whipping in a cross isn't going to like be grounds for benching George Bello.
No, definitely not. He played very well, and I think probably earned an automatic starting spot for Atlanta United too at the age of 16. Well,
so that's good news. But does Atlanta United have a need for a dynamic attacking left wing back like this weekend, pal? I feel like Greg Garza's out, isn't he?
Oh, is he? That's news to me. I didn't know that.
I think Greg Garza is out injured, and I feel like Bells. I mean, why not George Bello in the first 11 for Atlanta United?
I mean, that'd be too much to hope for me, just emotionally. But I don't think it's that far off. I honestly don't think it's that far off. I think he's playing. So just for instance, against Charlotte, he's playing against two 25-year-olds, a 25-year-old right wing and a 25-year-old right back, and had essentially had his way with them. I mean, he wasn't totally dominant, but it was his flank. And those 25-year-olds, one of them's got 20 caps with Trinidad and Tobago. The other one has been on the roster for the Liberia national team, came up in the Valencia youth system. I mean, these aren't blue bloods by any stretch of the imagination, but they're real opponents, real men who play professional soccer, and Bello had no trouble with them. And a kid just turned 16 like 2 months ago. So I don't think we're too far off from a first team debut for him, especially if Garza is injured. I don't know. Are you sure he's injured for this weekend?
I saw that Garza's out, but keep in mind that would mean that he's going to go from the 25-year-olds on Charlotte to Carlos Vela.
Right, yeah. I'm not saying he's ready for that. I'm not going that far. I just think I think he'll be ready for it by like June. He'll probably get some Open Cup runouts with Atlanta United. And yeah, we'll see how it goes. But
given he's on a good track. George Bello on a good track, doing all the things that you would need a 16-year-old to be doing if you were hopeful that he was going to be the left back of the future for the U.S.
Well said. Couldn't have said it better. I think that's a judicious and concise way to sum it up. I think we're done. I'm gonna do a special episode with Dylan Payne next week about drafting a 2022 World Cup roster, because Greg is too cranky for that.
Oh man, those picking one guy to actually succeed 5 years from now is tough, but I'm excited to see where George Bello goes in that draft.
Yeah, I'm not tipping my hand, but maybe we'll have a follow-up episode where you're going to give a failed corollary.
Yes, and I mean that respectfully to any of the players who are, because it's not a failure of any player. A lot of those players that sort of failed to save the U.S. national team are playing professional soccer It's a failure of people to, you know, not put excessive expectations on them.
Right. Right. Yeah. Important distinction.
You know.
Okay. Well, thanks, Greg. Much appreciated. And thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back next week.